taking kitchen scraps and other items and dumping them in a bin to let nature do its thing. Just what is that thing? Even people who do compost may be unclear on the creation of something new from the decay of something old, a death from life, if you prefer. Our final guest today is both Master Gardener and Master Recycler. Rodney Bloom will talk about compost on Sunday at 2 at the Eugene Library, and he's here to give us a little preview. Rodney, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Jeffrey.
What got you interested in composting in the first place?
That's a great question. And the answer is that, long story short, my father grew up, both my parents grew up during the Great Depression. And they were very conscious about waste, you know, whether it was wasting electricity or wasting food. I embrace that, and the first way that I did when I was a kid was my sisters started taking the cores from toilet paper rolls and dropping them in water, watching them sort of unravel and unfold. I was looking at that as a kid. I mean, I was, I don't know, 6, 7 years old, and was like, that's great. And they did it, you know, once or twice. I started doing it with every roll, and I started taking all that paper, and I started drying it on the radiator in my bedroom and saving it. And my parents came in one day, and they were like, what are you doing with, what is this? And I was like, this is paper. This is valuable. I've discovered how to do this. Isn't this great? And they were like, Rodney, throw all of that away.
They didn't want to call you a master recycler at age 8, I take it.
Way ahead of my time.
Uh-huh.
So, but, you know, I had the I had the realization of things that that other people thinking of trash that were actually valuable, and that extended to looking at banana peels and apple cores. And finally, it took about 30 years, but I took my first dip into worm composting.
So the talk on Sunday is titled "Composting Decay for the Masses," which makes you stop and think. It is decay, isn't it? I guess I hadn't thought of it that way. What is going on in there?
Oh, wow, there's so much going on. There's a lot of competition going on because you have first-level feeders. You have bacteria and fungi and actinomycetes, all microscopic, and they're eating whatever you're putting into the compost pile, into the compost bin, and they're holding on to all those nutrients in their body. It's now become part of their bodies. But then you have the next level of feeders. You have the nematodes. You have the protozoa. And as they start to prey on those first-level feeders, they're starting to release nutrients that were being held in the bodies of the bacteria and the fungi, and it's coming out, it's being released into the soil, into the compost, in a way that the plant can now take up those nutrients. So soil really has to be alive for nutrients to be able to be transferred from the soil to a plant.
You know, I had a chance to look at the presentations you've used in the past, which talks about a number of different things. One of them is the raising the question about compost. Why bother? And the answer, it sounds like, is what you just gave, that you need stuff to be alive in the soil.
You really do. And it can go so much beyond that. I'll jump right to global warming.
Okay.
And the idea is that with, of course, global warming, we have greenhouse gases, including CO2, the carbon that is being released from fossil fuels that's being dug up from the earth. Basically, that CO2 got in the earth from decomposition, and plants that arrested the carbon out of the atmosphere, eventually breaking down, decaying, becoming stable, and after millions of years of pressure, becoming coal or oil or other substances. You know, there's a group in Pennsylvania, it's called the Rodale Institute, and what they actually published a white paper, I think it was 2 years ago, but they did the calculations, and what they found was that if commercial agriculture started practicing regenerative farming, so they started using natural inputs and lots of compost in farming, that with everything else being the same, with as many cars on the road, with as many factories, as much heating oil, as much greenhouse gases being released into the atmosphere, that just from regenerative agriculture, that we would have an immediate net loss of CO2.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Is it possible to do agriculture, to do composting on the scale of industrial agriculture?
It is. There's so much. And remember that anything that was once alive is compostable. So we tend to think of our vegetarian food scraps or the produce food scraps that we put into a home compost bin. But it goes everything from managing human sewage, animal carcasses and so forth. All of that can be composted. Humans can be composted.
Perhaps we'll get to that at the end. Rodney Bloom is our guest on The Exchange, Master Gardener, Master Recycler. He'll be talking about composting decay for the masses Sunday at 2 at the Eugene Library. You can join him here now at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You draw some comparisons, I noticed, in your presentation between composting and landfills. And in a landfill, does really anything like composting happen, or is it just a tomb for trash?
There's a lot of ways to break down composting, but one way is to look at it as being aerobic or anaerobic. So whether it's happening in the presence of oxygen or the complete lack of oxygen. And what happens in landfills is that it's deliberately made anaerobic because the municipality has to spend a lot of money to create the pit that the garbage is being dumped in. So they want to get as much in there as possible. So after garbage is added to the landfill, you have bulldozers running back and forth, earth-moving equipment to actually crush it down and to pack it more tightly. In doing that, it creates an anaerobic environment, a lack of oxygen. And in that lack of oxygen, yeah, there's some entombment, but what is also happening is that microbes that live in the absence of oxygen are busy. They're hard at work. And the byproducts that they're creating include methane, which is, of course, a much more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. And they also create organic acids. And these acids tend to leach down through everything that's been thrown in the landfill, from empty insecticide cans, batteries, paint cans, whatever's been going in there, and leaching the toxins out of that material. And so finally this leachate reaches the bottom of the landfill as just this terrible soup.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. You're making a lot of converts to composting right here. And what is the general rule of thumb, Rodney, for what does and does not go in compost?
Normally, you're putting produce waste into compost. The exception to that would probably be eggshells. So for the home composter, you're going to leave out the animal products. Yeah. You're not putting in meat, not putting in cheese, dairy, things of that nature. And that's when you're doing aerobic composting. So we're talking about hot piles, if you have enough material, enough volume, coal piles, or even worm composting. There is a composting method, though, that is becoming more and more popular. It comes from Japan, from Korea. It's called bokashi. And with bokashi, you can actually compost meat safely.
Really?
Yeah, it's really a pre-composting method. But what you're doing is you're taking the materials that you want to compost and you're fermenting them. You're putting them in a closed bucket, adding fermenting microbes, and basically the stuff comes out pickled. And it looks just like what you put in there. You're still pulling out a banana peel, a string bean, doesn't look anything like soil. But once you incorporate this fermented material into the soil, then it breaks down very quickly. And having done it in a cold composting manner in a sealed container, you are keeping a very high percentage of the nutrients in that original material. So, yeah, you can actually do meat doing bokashi.
Wow. We have a call here from Helga in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about composting with Rodney Bloom.
Hi. My father was a very enthusiastic mulcher and composter, so I learned it really early on. And right now in Talent, I'm having to build new soil because this town wants nothing but bark mulch. And I'm using the weeds from a weed team effort. And 1 year later, I am now sifting wonderful, rich humus.
That's great. So that raises a great question, Rodney, about how long the process takes and how user-intensive it is. What kind of maintenance do you have to do when you got compost going?
Mm-hmm. That depends on how much energy and how much resources you want to put into it. You can certainly build up soil, especially when you have poor soil, clay soils and such. You can build it up gradually. And if you're home composting, that's probably what is going to happen. And in that case, it's usually best to build up small areas completely, work with small patches instead of trying to do a large garden and not changing the soil as much. Part of the beauty, certainly, that we have up here in Lane County is that we do have commercial composters where you can just go and or they'll deliver. You can go and get a truckload of soil if you want to make big change in a short time.
So you mentioned hot and cold and the worm composting. Obviously, you've got to have the worms to start that version. But what determines whether you're going to do hot or cold?
One thing that determines hot is volume. So usually to be able to do a successfully hot compost, you're going to need to do a pile that's a cubic yard. So 3 feet tall, 3 feet deep, and 3 feet wide. With that much volume, which is 200 gallons of material, you have enough material so that the outside of the pile actually insulates the biological activity that's going on in the inside of the pile. So all those microbes feeding on the original material, other microbes preying upon them. But what happens is all of that activity actually raises the temperature in the core of the pile. And if you get up to 131 degrees, you're destroying pathogens, whether they're plant disease pathogens or human pathogens, Salmonella, E. coli, parasites, things of that nature. When you have just a gradual stream of materials coming out, like most people do, they're just looking to handle their food scraps coming out of the kitchen, and you're just adding that gradually to a compost, you never accumulate enough material to insulate and get that rising temperature effect. So that would be a cold compost. And worm compost is a good example of the cold composting method.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier the things that can, everything can be composted, right up to human beings themselves. I did notice the human manure handbook in your earlier presentation. Is that even legal to use human waste as compost?
Actually, it's being done on a pretty large scale. A lot of folks don't realize that if you're buying conventionally grown produce versus organic, that a lot of that has been grown, I won't say a lot of that, but some of that has been grown with human sewage.
After like the sludge sales from the treatment plants?
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So what the idea with the Humanure Handbook is that Joe Jenkins wanted to scale it down so people could do it at home in their backyards and so forth. And that varies from municipality to municipality. So you're actually able to use heat using a hot composting method and destroy the pathogens. But yeah, that will vary from town to town.
Yeah, check with your local officials before you get into something like that. The session is called Composting Decay for the Masses. Love the title. That'll be Sunday at 2 at the Eugene Library, and Rodney Bloom will be there to deliver it. Rodney, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me on.